The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Folio Austin Soiree. I'm Claire Armistead and I'm delighted to welcome our two speakers for this evening. As I'm sure you know, this is the 200th anniversary year of the publication of Pride and Prejudice. And as Jane is unfortunately unable to attend in person, we've drafted in two of her starriest champions. Faye Weldon wrote the screenplay for a 1980 TV serialisation of Pride and Prejudice that's remarkably, Faye, regarded as one of the most faithful by the Janeites, who are terribly stroppy, aren't they, in their defence of her reputation.
Yes, they're very particular. But actually, it did contain the novel and only the novel, and there was only half a minute in it, which I invented, which was Lady Catherine de Bourgh talking about how to lay eggs in the winter, how to make the hens lay eggs in the winter, which I got from Inquire Within on Everything 1789. So I thought I was entitled, but that was the only thing that was not Jane Austen, that was not the book, because I just fed the text into the mouths of the sisters, depending on how wise or how foolish or how sort of plot-filled they were.
Faye also is the author of an epistolary novel, Letters to Alice, which explains why we should read Jane Austen today. In fact, it explained in 1984 why we should read Jane Austen today, but Faye and I have just had the most fantastic half hour in the green room reading my Kindle version, in which I can see which passages have been highlighted by the people who we worked out would be the granddaughters of the Alice to which the letters were originally addressed in 1984. And there are sort of six and seven people who have earmarked particular passages, which I think illustrates one of our themes, which is what is the relevance of Jane Austen today? Well, clearly this 1984 book is being read. And our second guest is Joanna Trollope, who is the best-selling author of, I thought, more than 20 novels, although only 17. And she's just published the first in a HarperCollins series of reimaginings of Jane Austen, and she chose Sense and Sensibility, of which Stylist magazine said, a bloody good read, I was so charmed I missed my tube stop.
That's always good.
Which makes another of our points, which is the relevance of Jane Austen
today.
Can't
ask for more.
Let's start with you. Tell us why you chose Sense and Sensibility.
Well, it was offered to me, and I was very pleased because it is Jane's first book. It was published in 1809, and she'd been working on it, thinking about it, for about 16 years before it was published. And it had started as an epistolary novel about the two sisters, the two approaches to romantic love. But it is about romantic love, but actually it's a novel about money. And money, as we know from 50 Shades of Grey, is fantastically sexy. And Jane Austen knew exactly about the power of money.
So we were talking in the green room about the fact that she discovered 50 years after the birth of the novel, basically, the three themes of fiction, which is...
It's money, class
and
romantic
and love.
Romantic love.
Faye, over to you. How did she do that?
Well, she worked from first principles. It's just obvious. That would be what she would write a novel about. This was what consumed her society, and I would argue society today in the same way.
Exactly.
And nothing much changes. Once you realise... I mean, a novel is really just a kind of essay, but you fictionalise it and you kind of... make it do what you make the characters prove what you want them to prove.
You know, however disappointed she was romantically, which I think she got over, don't you, Faye? I don't think she minded. Well, she didn't mind the thought that she was never going to have a baby.
No, I think this was very true of the time. The penalty of getting married was that you had to have babies.
Immediately.
And if you had more than two or three, you were going to die.
Yes.
And as Murray Stope said, every baby you have in those days doubled the chances of you dying.
Yes,
so the
exactly.
More, and, you know, you had to be a kind of maternal sort of woman, which meant not necessarily a very intellectual woman, to want to get married because of the penalty.
But it was your only career
But it was also your only career because of the social pressure to get married. So you had to put up with that.
You had no financial independence.
No.
And I think, what's fascinating about this book and Pride and Prejudice, she refers to them, doesn't she, as my darling child. And she had absolutely no doubt about her gift.
Yes.
Did she? She never... Yes. If you read the letters that Cassandra didn't burn, there's about 160 yes. left.
Yes.
Her confidence in her gift, her acceptance of how good she was remarkable. And when you think that genre was half a century old when she embarked on it, she just knew.
Yes, but I don't think it was such a rare and extraordinary gift to have, and you might not even notice you had it. would just know that you had. They weren't surrounded by crowds of people saying how clever you are to have done this. You'd just have done it and taken it.
But she needed
that she
to.
Did it, and you have to, yes. Well, if you're that kind of person,
she was compelled
you have this
to. Yeah.
sort of gene. That's what you do. You just write, and you can't stop it.
Yes, yes.
I always think it's you know, I mean, if you find you're a writer, it's as if it's sort of like a knife stopping at you, and the sort of finger of, you know, the finger stops and points at you and says, you be the writer, and there's nothing much you can do about it. That's what you do forever.
And I think she was on the cusp of bestsellerdom when she died, and she was longing for it. She'd have loved it.
Yes. Joanna, tell us a little bit about what you had to do in order to bring Sense and Sensibility up to the 21st century.
Well, I stuck like paint to her cast list, and I stuck as close as I possibly could to her story. There is, unlike Faye's Pride and Prejudice, there is one original line of Jane Austen buried in that book, and I will give you a very big prize if you can find it. But I also stuck to Jane's attitude to the characters. So, for example, in the whole of Sense and Sensibility, there are only two people she doesn't tease. She was extraordinarily mischievous and very bold. She doesn't tease Eleanor Dashwood, and she doesn't tease Colonel Brandon. Everyone else is up for mockery, and mocked they get. So I found it really extremely liberating, because I could just follow her lead in this teasing. But every single person translated to either a modern type or a modern well-known character, there was absolutely no problem, because they are timeless. That's part of her genius. They are just types of people that we all recognise.
But there are technological challenges, aren't there? What do you do about the letters that are always going backwards and forwards? Well, and take quite a long time to arrive, which is part of the tension.
The leisure was a problem, but I came to the conclusion that all the leisure in Jane Austen was actually paid for by the great commodity of the day, which was sugar. And there was slavery hovering on the edges of all Jane Austen's novels.
Yes.
I mean, it was very dark. Occasionally, you know, like Mrs. Elton in Emma.
Yes.
You remember my brother, Mr. Suckling's seat, Maple Grove, near Bristol. That was plainly because Bristol was a great slaving port.
Yes.
You know, she approves of Mr. Knightley's money. She approves of Colonel Brandon's money. It's old money. They're paternalistic. They're Whiggish in their care for the people who work for them. She doesn't like new money much. She suspects it. But the Austens were all ardent abolitionists. There was the leisure and the wealth to cope with, so I had to give some people jobs. And obviously they text and email each other and defriend each other on Facebook and that kind of thing. Well, they have to. And Willoughby can't have a horse, can he? So, because he's actually such a bastard, he gets a leased Aston Martin. He's not allowed to own it. So, you know, there was quite a lot of a game in finding how I could fit things in. But there was nothing that was really a problem in terms of personality. And there were modern equivalents. You have to sort of up the game of some things. For example, Colonel Brandon's ward, Eliza, you know, does the unthinkable and has a baby out of wedlock. Well, I won't tell you what I've done, but I've had to upgrade that to a modern degree of something shocking, because having a baby out of wedlock is neither here nor there now. And, you know, when Willoughby takes Marianne to Allenham, he shows her, in the real book, he shows her the room that'll be her sitting room. Well, you can imagine what I have them doing that afternoon, because in this day and age, that's what they would do.
They're not downstairs, let us put it like that.
They are not, and Mrs. Smith is as deaf as a post.
You do play some lovely games with interior decor
Yes. The first chapter of the real Sense and Sensibility is for, to modern tastes, quite turgid, because it's a description of wills and entails to explain why the Dashwood women are left in this very straitened circumstances. And our taste for, in fiction is we need to be grabbed by the story, we need the action to start immediately. We're a bit more impatient. In the original, this rather dull first chapter is followed by one of the best scenes that she ever wrote. You know that wonderful scene where Fanny Dashwood talks John down out of giving his half-sisters any single penny out of his enormous inheritance. So I've just sort of pulled that up to the beginning.
Yeah. Did you feel intimidated at all by her reputation?
No, I felt she was kind of laughing at my elbow.
How about you?
Because it's still her book. It doesn't matter what you do to it. It's like a really good melody. You know, you can syncopate it, you can transpose it, and it's still that melody. And it's the same with a Jane Austen novel. You can't do anything too terrible to it.
And what about you, Faye? We ought to come on to all the stuff that you've done to Jane Austen. Which includes, we had this, I interviewed Faye at a little festival in Hampshire a few years ago, and I had this very strong memory of this series, in which, and the line, "You have delighted us long enough," was, I thought, she'd given it to Lizzie Bennet. So when I found it on YouTube, I found, no, she gave it to Mrs. Bennet. Which, of course, it is true to the line, but it totally changes the politics of the thing.
Yes, it does, but then I was sort of on Mrs. Bennet's side. And in a kind of way, rather than Mr. Bennet's, I thought Mr. Bennet was horrible. And Mrs. Bennet was, you know, his victim, and all she was trying to do was get her and the girls married off, because they'd live. How else were they to live? As indeed the Austen family ended up in living once Mr. Bennet had died, well, the father had died, sort of in poverty, on the, you know, looking for the welfare of the brother who had happened to marry well. So Mrs. Bennet was completely right, and I think Elizabeth was very, who I see as Jane Austen, was very miserable. And I thought that Jane Austen indeed was at my elbow, as one does if one adapts things. I once had Ibsen at my elbow. Can you imagine? But Jane Austen, and in a kind of way, she was sort of making an apology, I thought. I mean, it is...
Gosh, Ibsen must have been so thrilled to be at your elbow. So much more fun than Mrs. Ibsen's.
So you will be delighted to hear that six people have highlighted the Kindle version of you, this quote from you. "I take a tender view of Mrs. Bennet, more tender than her creator does, but I am looking at a society from the outside in, not the inside out."
Yes. Well, yes, I think that's true. But, I mean, she was in the middle of it. She couldn't see what we could see. Quite, because, you know, she's back in time, we can see it, but she's living through it. You don't see, really, as you're living through something, you don't really see what it's about. And she didn't know her own future, which we did. So, you know, so she would be on her father's side and wouldn't sort of despise her mother, because her mother didn't have a proper sense of romance, which Jane Austen did, as well as the sense of survival, as how you're going to get through this. And you know, and she was writing a novel. She was entertaining. She was also identifying very much, one felt, with Elizabeth, as one suspects she identifies with Eleanor. This is her, and you know, if you're wise, you do put yourself in the book and look at it from the inside out.
So you've got in Sense and Sensibility, your Belle, Mrs. Dashwood, is a rather sort of unconstrainedly romantic figure who's made a bit of a hash of things, really, hasn't
well,
she?
Well, she's where Marianne's come from.
She just admitted to marry her husband, which meant that they lost their house.
Yes, exactly. Well, that had to be the modern version, because if you are a common law wife, you don't have the rights of inheritance that a married woman has.
But often believe you do.
Which brings us to the second, another of the multi-highlighted quotes in Letters to Alice, which is five people, you'll be glad to hear, highlighted this quote. And it was about Jane Austen's books being studded with fathers indifferent to their families.
They were Georgian fathers, weren't they?
babies and mothers were sort of nursery stuff, and you sort of did that because somebody had to inherit. But you didn't sort of involve yourself with your wives or your children. You married, and as people's men still do, you know, women who are less intelligent than you, so the woman looks up to you and doesn't argue. And this is still the kind of... It's much less so than it was, because people tend to marry out of their offices or out of their work. And so, you know, marry somebody of an equal status, an equal earning, but women will still go on looking, young women will still go on looking for somebody who is richer than they are, who is higher up in the organisation. You will try and marry your boss if you can, and the boss will try and marry his secretary if she can. Nothing changes, you know. And so, you know, so on the whole, although it is much, much better now, and men do actually relate to their children very intensely now, in some circles, though not all, but certainly in guardian circles. and otherwise, they do tend to be indifferent, I'm afraid, to their wives and children, which is why women sort of set up a sort of apartheid between themselves and men sort of in the end.
In Sense and Sensibility, the father is dead, so that...
Yes,
that he sensibly vanished.
No, I think the thing is, Jane Austen's parents would have been Georgians, who were tough, robust. They weren't a sentimental, soft lot at all. I think, you know, you think the Austen household would have been quite austere physically, wouldn't it? Quite frugal.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at these houses and you think the number of people they managed to get in them, and the servants and everything, goodness knows, you know, in films they put them in great big houses because there's no other way you can fit them in. But it was much more cramped. And all the new Georgian houses we see were not the houses they lived in. It was houses that were built by the wealthy, the nouveau riche at the time. And if you in Sanditon, there's this wonderful description of the new houses, which everybody hated when they had to move out of the cottages into these new houses on these windswept hills with no trees and nothing.
Yes.
And they were the houses which we now see as so grand, which were then,
and probably jerry-built with no foundations.
Exactly. And no foundations and no basements, no areas.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yes.
But why do you say that they were an abolition family?
They were abolitionists as a family, the Austens, when it came to the slave trade.
I thought they sort of made rather a lot of money out of it.
Well,
or is that a foul rumour put about by some?
Well, I'm just quoting Paula Byrne and the...
Yes, I read another book.
Right.
But I can't remember. But the family were all sort of living on slave trade money. Sort of money coming in from Jamaica. But there was a terrific sort of abolitionist theory at the time. Anyway, it's not really interesting.
It isn't, except for this silent wealth sort of that surrounds all of Jane Austen and all those all the people who, you know, adore poor Colin Firth in his wet shirt in Andrew Davis's adaptation, a scene which is not in the book.
Yes.
I just feel I want to say to them, you know, excuse me, what about the slave trade?
Yes.
Well, you know, in a rather bracing manner.
Because it was a sort of elephant in the room then, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was. This wealth, which, you know, suddenly moved from landowning to trade.
Absolutely.
And overseas trade. And so
absolutely.
It was a time of great change.
It was.
Now, I'm going to go to the next quote from Letters to Alex, Alice, which was highlighted by seven people, the most highlighted passage I'm going to quote, which was, Jane Austen concerned herself with what to us are observable truths because we agree with them. They were not so observable at the time, which strikes me as that's a really shrewd point, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think she was sort of delineating all kinds of divisions between people, or saying, well, you know, more or less, there's romantic love and there's practical love, and you're going to have to choose between them. And this is, you know, the choices Elizabeth made, the choices Charlotte made. And she made it clear to people, so it was sort of very educative in its way, I think, because it's only through fiction that you sort of, the sort of morass of experience that you have, it's only through fiction that you are enabled to sort of pick out this from that, I think, which is why we depend upon it and go on reading it to such an absurd extent, when obviously it's much easier to watch a film, but films don't do this.
which brings you to the whole idea of the whole business of the Austen industry on film and television, where we totally identify with Lizzie, don't we, really? Whereas Lizzie was presumably quite radical in that it wasn't normal to choose to marry for love.
No, and it was, well, no, it wasn't. And what's more, it was very unlikely. It was very unlikely. I always thought that Darcy would have married her. He would have, Elizabeth, he would have set her up in St. John's Wood or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
But the class thing was so that you didn't just marry anybody, you married very carefully for property and inheritance and all the rest
like
of it.
Charlotte Lucas.
So it's a romance. It's it is a romance, and why not? Mm. But I don't think even she knew very much about how the aristocracy carried on, because how would you know?
No. Unless, I know when I was researching Sense and Sensibility, Barton Park, where Sir John Middleton lives, is a real house, which is called Pines, on the X River above Exeter. And Jane and Cassandra had been to see it when they had one of their holidays in Salcombe or somewhere like that. Because like Pemberley, it was open and you could go in and see it and that kind of thing. And then she put it in a book. So she would have seen it possibly as a visitor. Yes. But I'm always a bit troubled by Pemberley. I always feel that was the coal mines of Derbyshire built
that. Oh, absolutely. It was very unlikely. Nobody lived up there, really, in Derbyshire.
No.
But she'd seen the house and was up there and she put it in. And it was a romantic thing. But that
understanding of romance, because there were Gothic novels happening all around her, and they're not really romantic because they're a bit ridiculous, But she understood what is glamorous about romantic love, didn't she?
Well, of course.
And that's brilliant.
Well, of course, because it's sort of young girls yearning,
But no, but had young girls yearned? They hadn't yearned on paper the same way before.
No, but they did in real life, and they do it on paper because they do it in real life. Because, the hardness of reality enters in the
end. Yes, and then it's not so nice.
And it's not so nice. But, I'm sure girls then, girls in the Stone Age dreamt of
They surely did. Someone whirling by on a mammoth.
Well, exactly. Well, it's a sort of, the knight in shining armour, who's just going to come by and solve all your problems for you. You never need worry about anything ever again.
But it's not.
Pride and Prejudice is a romance. It's a romance. It's a Kitchen Girl romance.
But
it's lightened. I mean, the plot is just is absurd. But but it's lightened by these, by what her comments, her understanding, her definition of the world she lives in, and it's all attached to a really nice romantic novels, which obeys all the rules of romantic novels and is no different from any other romantic novel in that respect.
Well, it was a very early romantic novel,
isn't it?
Which brings us to the
point. I think that's
how much
important.
Did she imagine into being a certain way of thinking about romantic
novels? Oh, I think she did imagine it. It's one of the reasons. She was a complete pioneer.
Yes.
Wasn't she?
Well, she worked from first principles.
And she wrote under her own name, didn't she?
Yes,
because everybody who came after her had to pretend to be men.
And I've always, but then it was at a time when there was not so much feeling against women, oddly enough. It sort of hardened, I think, in the early Victorian times.
The infantilising of
women. Of women happened then.
What a grave mistake.
Being a creature of the new era, as I have clearly demonstrated by my knowledge of Kindles, I put it out to my Twitter followers what questions they would like to ask. And from somebody called VM Giambetto came this question, which is actually rather good, I think, which is, so much of Austen deals with boundaries and appropriate behaviour. Since we don't have the same rules and parameters today, where do we find boundaries and obstacles in stories where anybody can do anything?
Well, I find it extremely difficult to write contemporary fiction, which is why I've just done a trilogy set 100 years ago, because there are those boundaries. But times move so fast now, that it is really quite difficult to write contemporary fiction, because the boundaries change, and so much of fiction, you sort of depend upon an indignation or a sort of observation of what is going on. But by the time a book is published, which can be sort of, you know, by the time you've written its commission, you've done your synopsis, you've gone through all the terrible stages which publishers expect you to these days, by the time a book comes out, it can be 3 or 4 years later, by which time television programs are even worse because they can take up to 10 years these days to get on, by which time they're completely irrelevant, which is what's the matter with most television today, if you ask me. It's just fiction that has just taken so long, it no longer applies. Except serial killing, which goes on.
There aren't the boundaries of codes of conduct, you know, we're all much more informal than we were, but I think there are still tremendous moral boundaries. I think cruelty is still absolutely unacceptable. So is disloyalty. Enormous, indecent quantities of self-interest. I think all of those things create a kind of revulsion in people in general. So those kind of tenets yes. remain, even if it doesn't matter that you haven't written a thank you letter.
One thing which strikes me is how quickly people gather the mores of a time, how quickly they cut into understanding it, particularly the sort of sexual mores. It's as if everyone who reads have a kind of race memory of what the world used to be like, so they can, you know, just sort of drop into it very quickly, more quickly than one imagines possible.
The lady in purple just by you.
Hello, thank you very much for a very interesting talk so far. I just wanted to raise Mansfield Park, which hasn't been talked about very much, I think. I reread it recently and was struck again, to me, by how incredibly tedious the hero and heroine are, Fanny and Edmund, and how, to me, Jane Austen seems to really want some of the baddies, as it were, the less moral characters, who have all the best lines, as far as I could tell. What was your comment on that?
Oh, mine is, absolutely. I think that her great trouble was that she was told to write what she knew, not to invent. In the Juvenilia, she invents so wonderfully. And then Mansfield Park, she's doing what she's told, what she's meant to do. She's being discreet and ladylike and actually, but there was always this sort of, and I quite agree about Mansfield Park. You know, I've never been able to read more than the first 40 pages of it. I'm sorry. And
well,
simply,
you missed Mary Crawford.
No,
then,
I know.
Who's worth
I know.
It.
No, I looked her up on.
She is worth it, and she makes. She makes.
No, she
makes
does.
A very
no,
rude
she does.
Joke
yes.
about
yes.
Homosexuality yes. in the Navy.
And one does feel that, you know, the sort of great tragedy of her dying young was that actually if she'd been able to go on, she might have sort of got out of it and got into this sort of wonderful scenes in the sailors' homes and that, you know,
yes.
when she's not in her, she's inventing. It's just so, so much more.
But it works,
energetic.
Those scenes.
But it works, yes.
Faye, you mentioned a couple of times that she wrote with first principles. And I wonder if you could just expand on that.
Well, she hadn't read anything like herself as she was writing. So what she knew was she was relating directly to a reader, not sort of via creative writing classes and not via reviews and, you know, and not writing the kind of thing that other people wrote. She must have, in Northanger Abbey, for example,
yes,
she's obviously sort of read that, but it was her own style and she didn't take advice. She just wrote what seemed to her, appealed to a reader, and she was herself her own reader as she wrote, and she was entertaining herself as she wrote, not terribly, even self-consciously. She just sort of did it because it worked, and she liked to do it and felt obliged to do it.
I do agree with Joanna that Jane Austen knew the value of money, but I don't think that was the thing that she valued alone, and there were
not
lots of other things. And I think possibly what comes through in all of her books is that she values civility and just behind that, social propriety. What she didn't really value was romance.
That relates to In Pride and Prejudice, to Lydia, doesn't it? The romantic characters are sort of somehow bad.
But
the ones who are going to have a good
Lydia,
sex life.
Lydia running away with Wickham is sex.
Yes.
It's not love.
Okay.
She's a romp, Lydia, isn't she? She's
She's
you know,
bad
she's
girl.
A good time girl. Yes. Yes.
Willoughby and Marianne.
Well, that was, I think that was probably that we'd see, Marianne saw it as romantic love, but I don't think Willoughby did. Willoughby was very interested in sex. And I don't think it was just a way in to this very, very... You have to remember that Marianne was a complete epitome of the cult of sensibility, which was this surrender to emotion, this belief in the beauty of nature, and feeling that your heart was everything and your head was very little. And, of course, Eleanor's the reverse. And, of course, she was a pushover for a gorgeous man like Willoughby. And I think, I'm not sure he was, I don't think he was cynical, because at the end he says to Eleanor, he says, actually, that was the woman for me. But he was safely married to an heiress by then, so he could afford the luxury of saying to himself, yeah, my heart was really with your sister. No, I think she was very rational. I mean, if you look at the end of all six novels, she quite likes the tangle of the chase. But she gets to the end, and she says, in almost all of them, she says, I expect they were as happy as any other couple in their situation. She's sort of bored and on to the next thing. I mean, yes, she ties it up very hastily at the end.
Yes.
And it is different. You're quite right with modern fiction. We are interested. It was the Victorians, I think, who did that to us, wasn't it? Who said this business of romantic love, and now we've got to the point where you want to hand yourself over to somebody else because perhaps they can deal with all the bits of you that you don't care for.
Yes, and you had a rather low opinion of yourself as a woman, and the man knew how to do anything, everything, and Darcy is a tall, dark stranger.
Yes.
And, you know, he might have feet of clay if you look at him.
Sylvia Townsend Warner wrote a marvellous letter about Darcy doing up a birthday present for Elizabeth, about when they'd been married about 2 years, and Mrs. Bennet had come to stay for 3 months. And he was raging in the library, A, trying to do up this parcel, but also his mother-in-law was so unendurable. I don't imagine there were many jokes.
In the 1980 series, which you did, Darcy is sort of quite sinister, isn't he? He's not exactly a Colin Firth. He's very Voltpine, and you get this. I thought I got very.
Well, he only smiled once. David Rintoul, he was called.
It was David Rintoul.
And in the entire sort of, there were six episodes to begin with. Actually, he only smiled once in the last episode.
But you get a sense of him being a Mr. Bennet in waiting.
There wasn't this sort of communion between men and women, which there is today. Mm. Which at all, I think. Mm. They were different. Yeah, they were different. You know, men were these rather amazing, glorious figures who lived in the outside world and who went out to work and you stayed at home. And then the man would come back bringing all this sort of life and
energy. Like the Crusades.
Like the Crusades. And they indeed, you know, they came back home as a sort of purveyor of wealth, money, interest, conversation, the outside world, knowledge.
And more children.
And more children. And you I mean, you don't hear nowadays of sort of women adoring men, but women used to adore men, and the women used to fall in love with men in a way they don't now, with the most impossible people.
Well, it's that Wendy Cope poem about there are two things to do when you think you've fallen in love. One is to sit by the telephone waiting for him to ring and he doesn't. The other is to get to know him better.
Thank you very much to Joanna and Faye. And although I've been going on about the Kindle, it's partly because I'm totally astonished by it because I don't read on Kindle. I like to read these sort of books. And this is a really wonderful edition of Pride and Prejudice, which I covet and I probably won't get. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.